decorous affairs at Jimmy's home, his formal parties usually replete with a full dance orchestra and a more traditional guest list. Though not from the very top drawer, as many of the so-called Astor 400, society's creme, did not approve of Donahue. On one occasion, Jimmy insisted on showing them his basement rooms, explaining that they were for visiting servants. The Duke and Duchess politely and innocently admired the opulent Moorish design of these quarters, which were in reality used for late-night orgies. It was Jimmy's sly, knowing joke at their expense. However, as one professional to another, Wallace appreciated the fact that Donahue ran a faultless household. Everything ran like clockwork. As Billy Baldwin recalled, "Nobody ever served better food, had nicer servants, nor treated his guests with such kindness and generosity." Such was Wallace's respect that Donahue, together with Princess Ghislaine de Polignac, were the first outsiders invited to the Moulin de la Tuilerie, the 18th-century mill house situated 20 miles southwest of Paris, which they bought in 1952 and spent years converting. She shared, too, his love of porcelain, Jimmy quietly acquiring one of the finest collections of Meissen in America. Such was their eventual intimacy that there was a period when Donahue, an active Catholic, tried to convert Wallace to his faith. From these companionable beginnings, the friendship between Jimmy and Wallace intensified to the point where tongues began to wag. In the fall of 1950, while the Duke was in France working on his biography, A King's Story, with Colonel Charles Murphy, the Duchess sailed for New York, licking her wounds following the emotional fallout from the Rogers wedding. Jimmy was her consolation prize, a daring diversion during the daily social round. 20 years her junior, he made her feel young and lively again. Above all, he made her laugh. He was gay, in all senses of the word. A fizzy antidote to her suffocating husband and a jolly companion to help share the onerous burden of perpetually entertaining the Duke. "You have no idea how hard it is to live out a great romance," she once said. The two became inseparable, giggling and whispering in restaurants and nightclubs, their intimacy plain for all to see. One lunchtime, Baldwin was dining at his favorite restaurant just off Park Avenue on 59th Street, when he heard an absolute roar of laughter, and into the room, like two children, rushed the Duchess and Jimmy. They didn't see Billy, and headed for the back of the restaurant where there was very little light. Afterwards, they quietly went to Jimmy's apartment. Baldwin viewed their relationship as a heady flirtation, a chance for the Duchess to lose herself a little. In short, Jimmy got beneath the Duchess's rigid facade. "I know that during that time in her life, she had more fun than ever before. In a strange sense, Wallace had never had a beau, and Jimmy became her beau and treated her like a young girl. Jimmy said to me one evening before dinner, 'I just want to tell you something about your little Duchess. She's the best I've ever known. She's always considerate and adorable and never hurts me, as almost all the others do.'" Some have suggested that Jimmy and Wallace were the most unlikely of lovers. Others refused to believe that their relationship was anything other than platonic, especially as Jimmy had a longtime partner. Donahue begged to differ. After their eventual fallout, he boasted of performing oral sex on the Duchess, a sexual favor eagerly reciprocated. Those who knew him as a man instinctively sexually repelled by women see this as typically Jimmy, just boastful spite. As interior designer Nicholas Haslam, who was part of that wider circle, recalled, "Having known Jimmy, I can't think he could have touched any woman, let alone one as rigidly un-undressable as Wallace." Moreover, Donahue had a self-inflicted infirmity that made any kind of meaningful sexual congress painful and difficult. One night, in a state of drunkenness, he had circumcised himself with a penknife. Never in his life had he suffered such pain and agony. As a result, as Billy Baldwin delicately put it, he was grotesquely scarred and painfully sensitive. The Duke, too, was sensitive to the stories now regularly appearing in the New York press about his wife's antics. His American lawyer, Henry G. Walter Jr., even telephoned Charles Murphy to see if the Duke knew what was being written about him and to inquire if indeed their marriage was over. To Murphy's enduring frustration, the Duke scuttled work on his autobiography, claiming he had to be with the Duchess in New York, as it seemed likely that the Soviet Union was about to launch an attack on Europe. This was so much baloney, the Duke distraught that his wife was studiously ignoring his increasingly frantic phone calls. When Walter Winchell, the Dean of the Gossips, wrote in the New York Daily Mirror that the Duke and Duchess of Windsor are the Duke was sailing to meet his wife for a well-publicized dockside reunion, where they embraced several times for the benefit of the cameras. It was but a brief respite before Jimmy and Wallace resumed their whispering and giggling, passing notes to one another at dinner if perchance they were separated. The Duke was left in the cold, his presence barely tolerated by his wife. There was now a callousness and calculated cruelty about her scolding, the Duchess easily exasperated by her husband's slightest transgression. One evening she ranted at him for leaving the dinner table littered with his papers, knowing that she had guests arriving for dinner. Their relationship, which always had a dominatrix and submissive element, was now shorn of the bond of trust and affection that tethers such an intimate and complex human transaction. In short, she no longer loved him, or was even particularly fond of him. With every passing day, she found him more boring, mean, and limited. What once charmed, now irritated. What once captivated, now bored. And what delighted, now exasperated. Winchell was on the money when he wrote, "The Duke is a very sad person these days." Nothing he could do would satisfy her. When she was hospitalized in February 1951 for a hysterectomy after it was discovered she had ovarian cancer, he visited her every day, always bringing red roses and beluga caviar to tempt her taste buds. The lady was not for tempting, complaining that it was too salty and shooing him away. When she had recovered, she was soon back in the late-night routine. The Duke would tag along to nightclubs and restaurants with his wife and Jimmy, but was sent home earlier and earlier, Wallace continuing the party with Donahue and his friends. When he returned to London for his mother's funeral in March 1953, on the day of the burial, Wallace dined in New York with Jimmy at the Colony before going on to the El Morocco nightclub, where at some point Jimmy played the banjo. So much for court mourning, Wallace's behavior disrespectful not just of the late queen and the royal family, but of her husband, too. She was clearly beyond caring. "Why, they are in love," exclaimed the Marquesa de Portago to Charles Murphy in tones of disbelief. Theirs was a love affair, replete with lovers' tiffs. During one row between the Duchess and her unlikely paramour, she yelled, "And to think I gave up a king for a queen!" For such a self-controlled woman to be so publicly reckless dismayed her friends, she and gossip writer Elsa Maxwell falling out badly over Wallace's attachment to the Woolworth heir. The final straw was a series of phone calls the tipsy Duchess made very late one night, demanding that Elsa tell her where Jimmy had gone. Elsa said she wasn't his keeper and presumed he had gone home. The Duchess was insistent that he should be located. Eventually, Elsa said, "I have no idea where he went. I could care less, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself." Of course, this public humiliation of the once king and emperor could not continue indefinitely. The Duke's secretary, Anne Seagram, recalled the Duchess's demeanor after one late-night confrontation with her husband. He had been informed earlier that, in his own interests, He should be aware that his wife was going out every night with the same single young man. She heard him say, "It's not because you are the Duchess of Windsor, it's because you are my wife. Any man would mind his wife doing this." As Seagram noted, she was very quiet and submissive for a long time afterwards. Even though she cancelled that night's engagement with Donahue, as Seagram saw it, the Duchess reveled in this shoddy little success. Though a divorce was unthinkable, Wallace gave little thought to the impression her liaison gave to the outside world, not to mention the humiliation for her husband. This was a woman of iron self-discipline and control who gave nothing away even to her close friends. Yet, since Herman Rogers made his fateful decision to marry Lucy Wan in the summer of 1950, her mask had slipped. Wallace, unmanned by the loss of her closest companion and, as a result, throwing herself heedlessly into a wild and improbable romance. The crowning moment came on New Year's Eve 1953, when Donahue, ever the practical joker, organized a mock coronation for the Duke and Duchess at El Morocco. Watched by a rowdy, cocktail-drinking crowd, Donahue placed two elaborate paper party hats in the form of crowns reverently on the heads of the man who was once king, and the woman whose greatest desire was to be his queen. It was the closest they got to the real thing. The clicking cameras captured the self-conscious embarrassment of the moment, a joke tinged with tragedy. Later they went to a party where the Duchess went along the receiving line wearing her crown, the Duke resolutely holding his. Partygoer Bill Nichols, one of the few Englishmen to witness the affair, recalled, "One didn't know whether to be more surprised at the awesome insensitivity of the Duchess, or the awful weakness of the Duke." Gradually, though, the joke began to wear thin, even for the Duchess. As with most love affairs, it was the little things that irritated at first. Always a stickler for punctuality, Wallace was infuriated that Jimmy turned up late for meals, particularly during a 3-week Mediterranean cruise where Greta Garbo and English actor Rex Harrison were among the guests. There was a carelessness about his behavior that no amount of "I'm sorry" flowers could disguise. He offended the housekeeper in her. As theatrical as he was, for his part, Jimmy was weary of the faux formality of life with the Windsors. He was all play-acted out. The end was messy, bloody, and unpleasant. Jimmy had taken to kicking the Duchess under the table when she was regaling the company with a tale he thought boring. While the three of them were eating at a spa in Baden-Baden in August 1954, Jimmy lashed out when Wallace chided him over his garlic breath. He kicked Wallace so hard that she cried out. The Duke helped her to a sofa and stopped the bleeding on her shin. This was a Les Majesty too far. Red-faced and coldly furious, the Duke turned to Donahue. "We've had enough of you," he told him. "Get out." They never saw each other again. Typically, Jimmy had the last word. When asked about the rift between him and the Windsors, he quipped, "I've abdicated." Or as Walter Winchell would have written, Wallace and Jimmy were pfft. As for Wallace, the shutters came back down with a clank. From that moment, her mask was fixed. A few weeks after the end of her grotesque dalliance, she was back to her hard-boiled, wisecracking best. She was having lunch with Constance Coolidge in a starred Parisian restaurant. Over a perfectly prepared salad, Constance told her that the author Iles Brody, an ex-Hungarian cavalry officer who penned the tawdry bestseller Gone with the Windsors, which depicted the Duke and Duchess as monsters of egotism and self-indulgence, had dropped dead of a heart attack in a San Francisco street. Wallace paused mid-fork and said, "At last I can believe in God." Chapter 16. Ice runs through their veins. The letter was very un-Wallace-like. It was hesitant, apologetic, and nervous, with the tremulous tone of an errant lover asking for forgiveness. She was lost, and she needed help. As ever, she turned to the man to whom she had always reached out in times of trouble and doubt, Herman Rogers. Since the farrago of their wedding and honeymoon, he and his new bride, Lucy, had kept a deliberate distance from the Duke and Duchess. She acknowledged as much in her letter of August 18, 1955, sent from the Greedy Palace Hotel in Venice. "I find it very hard to write this letter, but here goes. Though as far as I know nothing has come between us, we have not seen each other when we have come to the Riviera. I felt, and I may be wrong, that the time you and Lucy dined with us at the Bonne Auberge, you had completely withdrawn your friendship from us. Something I need not tell you that I have prized very highly, and it has caused me great distress. And if you can think me capable of this emotion, shyness. Therefore I have not communicated with you on recent visits." Then she went on to explain why she was now in touch after so long. "However, I am, on the advice of George Allen, her lawyer, writing my memoirs. I personally detest this task, as again the flare of publicity will be mine. George's idea is that if I write my own memoirs, the books so inaccurately written about us will, after my death, not be used as reference in whatever way the future may depict me." She added that the Duke's ghostwriter, Charles Murphy, who had originally assisted Wallace, had been replaced by Boston-born humorist Cleveland Amory, whose touch she felt was much lighter and more in tune with her own thinking and style. "I am telling a simple story. No bitterness or reproach, etc. I have no diaries, nothing in fact but my memory to fall back on, and that is why I am writing to ask you if you could spare a few hours for Amory. It would be to check a few dates of the China days, a short picture of life there, Peking, as it was then. I seem so stupid about conveying the real atmosphere to him." As Herman had learned long before, nothing was as it seemed in Wallace's world. While she genuinely wanted to set the record straight for posterity, it was only one part of the puzzle. For some years, the Windsors had been concerned about two issues, their image and their bank balance. At an earlier brainstorming session about improving their public profile, their friend Claire Booth Luce suggested they adopt a British war orphan and call him David. This, she argued, would help soften their image as leaders of cafe society and make them seem more sympathetic and compassionate. Even the Windsors realized that this was a non-starter. Not only would it be inconvenient for their own lifestyle, it would doom the boy's life. He would be forever compared to Prince Charles, the young heir to the throne. Their action would be dismissed as cynical opportunism. Instead, the Duke suggested inaugurating the Windsor Awards, which would sponsor travel for young artists. Not that they took much interest in the art world. On one occasion, the Duke, who preferred traditional to modern art, deliberately hung an abstract bought by Wallace upside down in their sitting room. She never noticed. Unsurprisingly, the awards lasted for only a couple of years before they were abandoned. The Duke and Duchess had a more pressing concern, for the clock was ticking on the release of official German Foreign Office telegrams and other correspondence which, while not depicting the Duke as a traitor to his country, revealed the embarrassing rift between him and his family, his empathy towards Hitler, and his defeatist wartime attitude. Without careful public relations handling, the documents could be a damning indictment of his wartime record. The Duke was duly agitated, concerned about the possible effect on his reputation. If Wallace were to publish her own story before the document's scheduled release in 1957, this would help them diffuse and deflect any judgment about their links to the Nazis. Of course, there were financial considerations, too. The Windsors, like many rich people, constantly complained that they were living in virtual penury, even though their coffers at the Morgan Bank in New York were regularly replenished with inside stock tips from top businessmen like Robert Young, as well as the Mellons, the Dillons, and the Paleys. Their belief that the wolf was howling at their door conditioned their behavior, with avenues for official work consistently blocked by the royal family and the British government. They cast around in the private sector. During a visit to Los Angeles, the Duchess approached Hollywood mogul Sam Goldwyn for some kind of job for her husband. She came away empty-handed, Goldwyn remarking, somewhat gnomically, "I like the Duchess's frankness, but frankness and honesty aren't the same thing." Such was their reputation that it was said they asked for appearance fees when they honored an event with their presence. The 1951 Kentucky Derby was the most notorious example, rumors swirling that they had been paid for their attendance, a story that the Duke's biographer, Charles Murphy, always heartily denied. Yet at the time, this widespread belief informed the behavior of Louisville high society, who were scheduled to entertain the ducal couple. Well-to-do Louisville matriarch Standiford Danforth Gorin wrote to her son, Standiford, also known as Tank, informing him of the local gossip. "We do not know if they are paid a set sum to make their appearance at the Derby, and if their hosts have to pay them so much for the privilege of entertaining them. The story goes that the wife of the president of Churchill Downs, Mrs. Coram, called up Mrs. Benning Chambers and asked her if she would like to give a cocktail party for the Windsors. She said, 'Hell no,' even though she was to be reimbursed for their outlay." In the end, the couple returned to the tried and tested and decided that the Duchess should follow in her husband's footsteps and write her own book. The Duke had done very well out of his ghosted autobiography, A King's Story, making more than $1 million in book sales and serialization. Could lightning strike twice? Even though Life magazine and the Express newspaper group had seen record rises in circulation as a result of their serialization of the Duke's story, Life chairman Daniel Longwell did not think the Duchess's story worth publishing. He noted that the Duchess wanted quite a lot of money and did not think the book was worth the risk. "There's no enthusiasm here for the project," he cabled Charles Murphy. Murphy, along with feminist writer and critic Dame Rebecca West and, somewhat improbably, Ernest Hemingway, who had met Wallace in Cuba in 1950 when he created a local sensation after meeting them in his trademark shorts, were the names in the frame to ghostwrite the tome. When Life dropped out, McCall's magazine stepped in America, the British rights staying with the Express Group. As a first advance, Wallace was handed a $500,000 check by Kenneth Rawson of the David McKay Publishing House in New York. In Britain, Express publisher Max Aitken wanted the same winning formula that had propelled the Duke's memoirs to best-selling status. Murphy, somewhat reluctantly, was once more dragooned into service. He struggled with the project. The Duchess, like the Duke, difficult to pin down for the rigorous timetable needed for literary reminiscence. Moreover, he discovered that the Duchess had only a passing acquaintance with the truth, adapting or removing inconvenient facts from her story and, in tape-recorded interviews, changing her story at whim. The Duchess described it differently, telling Herman, "I felt Charlie, though excellent for the Duke, was not for me. His writing combined with mine was not a natural mélange. Therefore, I changed writers in midstream. I switched to Cleveland Amory." During the 1950s, Boston-born Cleveland Clip Amory was one of America's best-known humorous writers. His two bestsellers, The Proper Bostonians and The Last Resorts, gently poking fun at the pretensions of American high society. When he was first approached by the Windsors, he was sympathetic and enthusiastic, feeling that the Duchess of Windsor had been traduced by the British establishment. As an unapologetic Francophile, He was also eager to spend a few weeks working in Paris with his actress wife, Martha, along for company. The $25,000 advance was not to be sneezed at, either. The Duke was equally impressed, telling a friend, "That's a very self-assured young man. If I had his assurance when I was King of England, my life might have been very different." As his stepdaughter, Dr. Gaia Linehart, recalls, they entered the project thinking that the snooty British were disdainful of the Duchess because of her sexual activity and numerous marriages. They initially believed that she had been misrepresented, but soon came to realize that that wasn't so. The 6 months Amory spent talking to the Duke, Duchess, their friends and family gave him a unique window into Wallace's world and her fractious relationship with her husband. His wife, Martha, watching from the wings, found herself appalled by their personal interaction, her meanness, his cowardice. Though sophisticated and worldly, Clip showed his naivete in all matters royal family with his first suggestion of a title for the proposed autobiography. He called it Untitled, a clever play on the book title and the Duchess's own lack of the appellation Her Royal Highness. It was a proposal met with dead silence by the Duke and Duchess, Clip not for a moment aware how deep a wound that lack had caused in their lives. He soldiered on, keen to amuse them with his cleverness and wry humor. So he was further bemused when Wallace, with her reputation as a wit, never once laughed at one of his mots. In desperation, he asked Noel Coward how she had earned such a standing. "In those circles, old boy, it was not that difficult," Coward deadpanned. The scales were rapidly falling from Clip's eyes. On their first day of working together, he had a clear sense of who ruled the roost. He never forgot it. Clip and the Duchess were having tea and talking about the book when the Duke wandered in, teacup in hand. He started to talk about how he and Colonel Murphy had worked on his book. Wallace snapped, "We're not talking about your book. We're talking about my book. Take your tea in the other room." He duly went, leaving Clip wondering that if she treated him like that in the presence of a relative stranger, how did she talk to him when they were alone? Soon he and Martha began to appreciate how gratuitously vicious she was towards the Duke, exhibiting a consistent cruelty that left him, if not crying openly, certainly in tears. She would, for example, allow her pug dogs into the sitting room, but keep his out, much to his distress. "My mother was appalled by Wallace's behavior towards a man who, after all, had been the king," recalls Dr. Linehart. She was like the Joan Crawford character in the movie Mommy Dearest, switching from siren to saint to sadist. Martha described their fights as ducal dueling, this domestic description endorsed by a former private secretary who recalled that in the evening, when drink had been taken, the sound of their drunken bickering was unbearable. As the Duke's biographer, Philip Ziegler, succinctly observed, "She was harsh, dominating, often abominably rude. She treated the prince at the best like a child who needed keeping in order, at the worst, with contempt. But he invited it, and begged for more." As with so many fading marriages, it was the little things about the Duke that would send her into a frenzy of irritation. She hated his incessant singing of jingles from adverts he had seen on television, and his use of Americanisms such as "I guess" or "making a buck." As Wallace admitted, "It made me simply furious." The Duchess was a complicated person. "Cold, mean-spirited, a bully and a sadist," observed Dr. Linehart. "My parents found the Duke not very bright, a wimp, and basically a very sad man. He had made an appalling choice and knew that he had taken the wrong path and now had to live with the consequences. They found him pathetic." Every day he would appear in the Duchess's quarters at precisely 11:30 to receive his daily marching orders. When the Duchess called, he came running, on one occasion leaving his barber mid-haircut to attend to his wife. Yet however mean she was to him, He was always considerate of her. He refused, for example, to allow her to handle old francs, so each day he gave her a wad of freshly minted notes. He was like a child in her hands, Lady Alexandra Metcalfe told Clip. Poor little man. He was given hell. It was a stranglehold she had over him. Their empathy towards him was, though, tempered by his anti-Semitism and continued sympathy for Hitler. Clip, a World War II vet, had little time for his views, especially as he began to see that the Duke's support for Hitler was much more comprehensive than he had ever imagined. My parents were horrified by their dinner table talk, where they made it perfectly clear that the world would have been a better place if Jews were exterminated, recalls Dr. Leinhardt. Clip recounted two stories to illustrate the Duke's views. On one occasion, he amazed an English friend when the subject of Hitler came up.
I have never thought Hitler was such a bad chap, said the Duke.
At another dinner party, admittedly after the Duke had been drinking heavily, he took hold of the hands of a lady guest, intertwining his fingers in hers to illustrate the point that before the war, the Jews had their tentacles around German society.
All Hitler tried to do was free the tentacles, he told her as the other guests looked on in horrified silence.
Finally, New York advertising executive Milton Baio interjected.
Sir, he said, with all due respect, I never believed I would ever hear at a civilized dinner table a defense of Adolf Hitler.
Even the Duke had the grace to blush. The Amorys were given a window not only into the beliefs of the Duke and Duchess, but also into their extravagant, if vacuous, lifestyle. As sophisticated as they were, even the Amorys were impressed. In an excited letter she sent to Clip's parents in July 1955, Martha recalled a fabulous weekend at the newly renovated mill near the village of Gif-sur-Yvette.
It has to be seen to be believed. I think she has done a brilliant job of combining bold colors and various styles, which result oddly enough in a comfortable, conservative effect. The Fort Belvedere furniture looks lofty and relaxed in its new setting. The grounds around are like a Corot painting come to life. The Duke spends every waking hour in his garden, and the results are breathtaking. There was monumental excitement when we arrived, as the Duke had cut his finger weeding. Cocktails on the terrace, the Duchess wore a periwinkle and large collar necklace of sapphires and aquamarines. The Duke wore a kilt, which suited him. It doesn't make him so old and shriveled. I was terribly amused as Princess Dimitri turned to me as we were all wallowing in caviar and helping ourselves and said, I do love pretentious picnics, don't you? As for the interior, Martha described chandeliers like mushrooms, exquisite Louis XV furniture, fabulous porcelains and crystal. There was a caveat. Although she is warm and informal to be with, the atmosphere of formality and protocol around here is nerve-jangling. Not that everyone was impressed. Interior designer Billy Baldwin described the Duchess's handiwork as awfully tacky.
But that's what Wallace had. Tacky southern taste, much too overdone, much too elaborate, and no real charm, he observed.
Amory could be forgiven for thinking the same about his subject. As Murphy discovered earlier, she was as tricky as mercury to pin down on facts, and like her husband, she routinely canceled scheduled interviews. Or as Amory put it,
here today, gone to Italy for 10 days tomorrow.
When she was ready for a tape-recorded interview, she rarely allowed a chink of daylight behind her mask. Martha reported, Clip sees Duchess every other day, depending on how much material we get. She loosens up a bit, but no sooner does she start to give things than she clams up again. He complained to his publisher, Kenneth Rawson, about her repetition, vagueness, and insatiable desire for change. Eventually, he suggested to the Duchess that if she was going to write a book, it might be helpful if she had ever read one.
Not that her husband was any better. His nervy character never allowed him to settle with a book or a magazine.
"Who is the Brontë woman?"
he once asked Frieda Dudley Ward when she handed him a copy of Wuthering Heights. When Winston Churchill dutifully sent him the latest signed volume in his multi-volume work, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, the Duke wrote back,
"Thank you so much for sending me a copy of your latest book. I have put it on the shelf with all the others."
Though Wallace had, as her second husband, Ernest Simpson, testified, a near photographic memory, she was forced to admit there were large chunks of her life that were absent from her recollections. As a result, Amory was sent off to London and elsewhere to interview Ernest Simpson, Fruity Metcalf, Lord Brownlow, the hero of the flight to Cannes during the abdication, and others to help flesh out her story. It meant Amory was learning the true story rather than Wallace's version of events. The interviews were arranged by Wallace's lawyer, now Sir George Allen. Martha and Clip, sensing that he was eager for them to understand the real Wallace rather than the fake public image. Martha wrote, "He was wonderful to us in London, but he felt he didn't think much of either of them and had done his best to give us the true story through others." They went right to the top of the tree, spending several hours with the Queen and her young children, Prince Charles and Princess Anne, at Windsor Castle. Sadly, Clip's notes from that historic encounter have not survived. Ironically, Martha remembered that the informality of dealing with the sovereign was a refreshing change from the stiffness of the exile's court in Paris. As they insinuated themselves with Wallace's inner circle, the Amorys discovered that there was little enthusiasm among her family and friends for an autobiography, nor any feeling that it would be a truthful account of her life. Her ever-faithful Aunt Bessie simply didn't think she was worthy.
If she had done anything important in her life, art, literature, philanthropy, by the time she became a duchess, then all right. But these little stories of childhood don't amount to much. If I said this to her, she would take my head off, but I don't think she holds the position in life she should. But don't tell her any of this.
Herman and Lucy Rogers, in the middle of building a new villa, which they named Crumwald, after his family home, entertained Clip and Martha for 5 days, the foursome becoming fast friends. As Martha told her in-laws, "We loved them and learned so much from them, so much that we can't use, but it was exhausting and fascinating." Herman cast his eye over Clip's early drafts and thought he had done a great job. There were caveats, though. Not about the writer, but the subject herself. The Rogerses felt that Wallace should never have embarked on a project that involved a close relationship with the truth. In the coming weeks, Clip found himself unable to reconcile Wallace's version of events when measured against the testimony of those, who included the Queen, he had spoken with during his research. He discovered, for instance, that almost everything the Duchess had told him about Ernest Simpson, his first wife, and their divorce was simply not true. Furthermore, he found the Duchess's meddling with his prose exasperating, writing to his editor, Kenneth Rawson,
"My worst problem, aside from her desire to change ideas, is that never in my experience have I seen anyone who knows so little what a paragraph is, what a chapter is, and what a book is. She has absolutely no conception of unity."
In mid-September, he severed all connections with the Duchess and his publisher, Amory deciding that he was no longer able to be connected with such a dishonest book. Explaining why he had given up the ghost, he told the media,
"I couldn't turn the Duchess into Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm."
That is to say, a plucky and endearing innocent at large. Ever the journalist, it was his wife's phrase, which he used as his own. Even though he had thrown in the literary towel, he and Martha were invited to dine with the Windsors before they departed. "It is all coolly amicable," wrote Martha to her in-laws in September 1955. "The casual way they can be dishonest makes you know that ice runs through their veins. Sir George Allen looked at Clip this morning
as though he'd wished he had the guts to do what Clip was doing 20 years ago. Wallace, who re-engaged Charles Murphy to finish the tome, told quite a different story. In a letter to Herman in December, she thanked him for his time and trouble, but then went on to describe Amory as a vicious character, whose work had been rejected by the various publishers underwriting the project. "I never had a cross word with him, and felt very badly about the whole affair. However, he turned upon me in the press like a viper." She was especially irked by what Herman had apparently said to him about her. "He is particularly delighted with your having, so he says, told him that I never stuck at anything that appeared in Banner headlines." As her marriage to the Duke of Windsor had made headlines around the world, it was a clear reference to her disillusion with her third husband. Herman subsequently took issue with Clip. "Did I really say this to you? If so, I don't remember having said it, and I don't think the remark would be fair, until just recently." He and Lucy, though, were very much behind the Amorys, believing that Clip had made the correct move to walk away from the project. In a letter to them in January 1956, Lucy reported that Wallace had sent them a copy of Murphy's final manuscript and asked Herman to comment on the contents. Lucy wrote, "There will be no comments on the truth. She can't take it, so it is no good telling her, and to make a hypocritical analysis, Herman would never do it. It would not be him. We think it would have been much wiser not to publish the book. Qui s'excuse, s'accuse. And there are at least 3 phrases in the chapters we are reading which are enough to make her unlikable to every decent human being, as much as one would like just for Christian brotherly spirit's sake to point it out to her. One can't do it. Herman says, what's the use? She would not understand anyhow." In spite of their misgivings, the serialization of the book, named The Heart Has Its Reasons, a phrase taken from the writings of the Enlightenment thinker Blaise Pascal, was launched with a lavish fanfare at the Waldorf Astoria in New York on February 20, 1956. While specially invited guests feasted on 6 pounds of the finest caviar, 300 clams casino, oysters Rockefeller, and tiny Roquefort cheese foyers passed in small heaters, Wallace held court, the royal author confiding to Phyllis Battelle of the Baltimore News Post, "To tell your heart to the world is a terribly difficult thing to do, like sitting looking in a mirror all day long. You must be truthful, correct, and not too dull." While it was an assured international bestseller, the critical pickings were slim, especially in England. In The Spectator, Gerald Fay wrote that the opening events of the book are commonplace and would not detain the busy reader for more than a few minutes. Wallace saw only the positives. Several days after the launch, she wrote to Herman saying that "the press has been kind and I think it has been well received. I'm glad this launch is over. I hope you'll think the style is dignified." All through her correspondence about the book, Wallace extended an enthusiastic invitation for the Rogerses to join them at the mill. Lucy graciously declined on the clearly spurious grounds that they were too old to travel such a distance from the south of France to Paris. It was perfectly plain that Lucy, though still beguiled by royalty, had no wish to repeat the competitive confrontation that marred her wedding and honeymoon. If Herman's second marriage was the last sentence in his long love affair with Wallace, the publication of her autobiography was the full stop. Wallace and the man she called the love of my life would never see each other again. At some point during the year, Herman contracted Parkinson's disease. He traveled to the Presbyterian Hospital in New York in a desperate attempt to find a cure. In vain. In October 1957, Lucy wrote to the Duke and Duchess, informing them of the gravity of Herman's illness. The Duchess sent a heartfelt letter on Saturday, October 19th, that expressed their affection for their ailing friend. "Dear Lucy, We have just returned from a shooting expedition and found your note with the sad news about Herman. You can well imagine how deeply the Duke and I feel about his illness. Though we have seen little of Herman these last few years, our love and gratitude to him for his staunch friendship to me for many years, and to the Duke at the most difficult time of his life, remains. I hesitate to telephone to hear his voice once more, in case my unexpected call would make him suspicious. I hope, Lucy, that if there is anything that we can do for you, that you will feel free to call upon us in any capacity you would need us. This has been a sad year for me. I have lost several good friends, but no one could leave the gap that Herman will should his illness prove fatal. Dear Lucy, my heart goes out to you at this distressing time. Let me hear how things go. My love and understanding, Wallace.
2 days later, on October 21st, 1957, Herman died in Lucy's arms. Grieving, bewildered, and heartbroken, Lucy focused her anger on the Windsors. She was furious that they didn't make the effort to attend his funeral, or even send flowers, even though, before Herman died, Wallace had written to say how much she loved him. Of course, it was all about Wallace. According to Lucy, when she finally sent a telegram of sympathy, it read in part,
"All my love and sympathy over your and my loss."
Lucy wrote back saying that Herman had already been buried along with Catherine, and described his beautiful, serene, dignified service. Lucy vented her true feelings in a furious letter she sent to the Amorys.
"What do you think of it? She did not even send a flower. Not that we cared, but I think in such a circumstance the Duke should have flown down from Paris and pay a last homage to their only real friend. I am afraid you can't teach little people to be grand, and grandeur comes from the heart. Herman should have left them a bit of it in his will. He had so much. He was really the most outstanding person I ever met. He had all qualities and no faults. I adored him, and always will continue to do so." For all Lucy's anger, she had a bizarrely ambivalent attitude to the Windsors. She had enjoyed her previous proximity to the ducal couple, basking in the social cachet it had given her. In her heart and mind, she wanted to be recognized by future generations as the Mrs. Rogers who was closest to the royal couple. Shortly after Herman's death, she busily began to put that warped plan into effect. When Catherine died, Herman had the phrase, "Strength and honor were her clothing," engraved on her tombstone. After his death, Lucy had the words chiseled off in a frankly unhinged attempt to expunge the public record of her influence on his life. As a further bizarre twist, Lucy took the name Catherine for herself, and when she died, on January 4, 2000, she was buried in the same plot as Catherine and Herman. Moreover, she left instructions that she was to be interred wearing a dress once worn by Catherine. She felt that if she, Catherine, and Herman were ever exhumed from the plot they now shared, people would identify her body as that of Catherine, who was much closer to the Duchess than she had ever been. Her astonishing behavior, this weird royal obsession, helps explain why, for all her vitriol toward the Windsors, a few weeks after Herman's death, Lucy immediately accepted an affectionate, open invitation from the Duchess to visit them in Paris in December. After all, when Herman was alive, she and her husband regularly turned down invitations to the mill. On her weekend stay in December, the only other guest was to be Queen Mary's official biographer, James Pope Hennessy, who, Wallace reassured her, was charming. He planned to interview the Duke about his late mother. During their conversation, the Duke complained to Pope Hennessy, "I played fair in 1936, but I was bloody shabbily treated." It must have given Lucy a satisfying sense of control to know that she was now the font of all knowledge about dear Herman. She could now hold court over Wallace, tantalizing her about the only man I have ever loved. The ultimate triumph was hers. Two social climbers, but only one, reached the summit of Mount Hermon. As Wallace admitted,
I want so much to hear all about Hermon these last years. I have never had such a sad year. So many friends gone and tragedies to others.
Sadly, her losses would continue. A year later, on November 30th, 1958, her second husband, Ernest Simpson, died. He was 61. And then there was one. Chapter 17. Wallace, 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 Wallace. Tucked away in a concrete storage facility at the rear of the Maryland Historical Society in Baltimore is a painting that gives an unexpected insight into the interior life of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. While they had been photographed together endlessly, this work was the first commissioned painting of the two of them since their marriage. The commission, undertaken by local artist Trafford Klotz, in part to commemorate their 25th year of married life, is unique. Klotz, a society artist who had also painted the Queen Mother, the widow of King George VI, set the couple in the lush Palm Beach garden of Arthur Gardner, the former American ambassador to Cuba. The Duke was seated on a padded garden chair looking out into the middle distance, the spiritual home, as they like to say, of the English intellectual. The Duchess, in a canary yellow day dress, was perched somewhat uncomfortably on the arm of a garden sofa. Significantly, she occupied a position higher than that of the former king. While she is looking in his direction, she is not looking at him. Her whole demeanor is blank, expressionless, her bored gaze reflecting perhaps the tedium she felt at the whole artistic exercise, or her marriage. For what Klotz depicts, either deliberately or unconsciously, is a married couple without an ounce of personal interaction. The two people at the center of a great royal romance inhabit two separate universes, lost in their own thoughts. Neither gives the other a hint of acknowledgement or recognition. As Mark Letzer, president of the Maryland Historical Society, observes, "As a couple that epitomized the love story of the century, they seem somewhat disengaged and posed. Interesting, too, is that they look into space and not at one another nor at the viewer. The palette is fresh and verdant, but it belies the bored countenance of the sitters." If Klotz was trying to make a shrewd statement about the state of their union, he never admitted as much. His private correspondence about his 1961 work focused on his interesting conversations with the Duke about World War I, and the difficulty of getting the Duke's pug dog, Mr. Chow, to sit still. Yet Klotz, perhaps in spite of himself, succeeded in capturing the sense of emptiness, estrangement, and distance that existed between them, a state of affairs familiar to those who knew them at that time. It is as if the ghost of Gertrude Stein was hovering over the portrait. There is no there there. Appropriate, too, as by a curious quirk of geography, the Duchess had artistically come full circle. During the war, Stein, her one-time neighbor on Biddle Street, had written a book, Ida, about a woman modeled on Wallace Simpson, who was famous for being famous. 20 years later, Klotz put the finishing touches on his portrait of the ducal couple at his studio in Branch Alley, Mount Vernon, just 4 blocks away from Wallace's former Baltimore home. Neither work, though, found favor with the Duchess. She sent Stein a somewhat baffled note of thanks when she received a copy of Ida, while she and the Duke smiled politely at Klotz's efforts and moved on, gracefully distancing themselves from a portrait that was a touch too close to home. During the time Klotz was working with them, the Windsors were generally viewed as a couple killing time, their lives one of entertainment, dancing from one party to another. The Duke had become such a bore that guests would inwardly shudder if they were seated next to him at dinner. His increasing deafness did not help. "Morning glory," was how Churchill dismissively described the man he became, his extraordinary promise bleeding into vacuity.
It was a really empty life, but it was what they enjoyed, noted a former private secretary. She loved anything to do with a party. They were wretched personalities, completely egocentric.
Their rigid daily routine was effectively the third wheel in their marriage. Their 11:30 morning meeting, her lunch with friends, his afternoon golf, his 7 p.m. date with a bottle of 25-year-old malt, her 7:30 hairdresser appointment, their dinner party at 9. They were always aware that they were under scrutiny, whether in public or private, and acted accordingly. If they went to a restaurant and their conversation faltered, the Duchess insisted that they recite the alphabet to one another, so that other diners would see their animation. On one occasion, they were in the same restaurant as Hollywood actor Clark Gable and his new wife, Kay Williams. They noticed that the couple were looking silently at each other, and they started to discuss the state of the Gables' marriage based on their lack of conversation. Then they burst into laughter, realizing they were guilty of doing to the Gables what so many others had done to them. If anything, that incident made them more determined to keep up the happy facade. At home, as Martha Amory observed, even if there was an audience of one around, you could guarantee a lovey-dovey scene to silence any doubters. I have seen it scores of times. At the same time, as Clip experienced during one of his first meetings with the Duchess, she was capable of casual cruelty towards her whimpering but ever-grateful husband. As the decades ticked by, however, no one really cared anymore. With the 60s in full swing, the Windsors were left behind, international society turning to new darlings like Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Aristotle and Jacqueline Onassis. When President Nixon invited them to the White House in 1970, they were no longer as socially active as they once had been.
"We're just too old," said the Duchess. "We even spent Easter in bed."
When their ghostwriter Charles Murphy visited them at their Paris home in April 1972, shortly before the Duke's death, he was shocked and dismayed by their lifestyle. In a letter to his collaborator Joe Bryan, he wrote, "How pitiable it all is. Now at the end, except for the Black Sydney, their butler, a late imperial acquisition from the Bahamas, they are quite alone among comparative strangers. The lady made it so. Whatever court there was, she was determined to rule. And now it is made up mostly of shadows, and the worst of the collaborationists and the robber barons." Age brought the ailing couple some compensations. By then there had been a slight thaw in relations with Buckingham Palace, the Duke's receipt of a telegram from the Queen congratulating him on his 70th birthday, a prelude to visits to their Paris home by various junior members of the royal family, including Prince William of Gloucester and the Duke and Duchess of Kent. It was all rather too little too late. After all, Emperor Hirohito of Japan had paid a courtesy call some years before. Nonetheless, this modest rapprochement was crowned by a visit from the Duke's niece, Queen Elizabeth, and Prince Philip, just before his 78th birthday in May 1972. The ailing Duke, who was suffering from cancer of the throat, insisted on getting out of bed and disconnecting what he called the damned rigging, his various tubes delivering morphine and other palliative care, before dressing in a suit and tie to meet his sovereign. Even though this was a courtesy call during the Queen's official visit to France, the Duke could not help raising, for what proved to be the last time, the possibility of his wife being given the appellation Her Royal Highness. Once again, he was denied, the Queen leaving open the family wound. At this critical time in his life, the Duke made the acquaintance of another girl from Baltimore, Julie Chatard Alexander, a feisty 26-year-old feminist who was earning money to pay for a trip of a lifetime to India with her fiancé. During the day, she ran an art gallery, At night, she worked a 12-hour shift as the night nurse on call for the Duke of Windsor at their final residence in Paris, Rue des Champs d'Entraînement, in the Bois de Boulogne. By now, there was no pretense that he was a patient under constant medical monitoring. It was a question of ensuring that he was made comfortable.